here and now. In a moment, our conversation with Michael Pollan, who asks, why are the poor heavier than the rich? Once to be poor was to be thin and hungry. But first, we want to check in Greensburg, Kansas, or what's left of it. 95% of the town was destroyed by the Category F5 tornado that plowed through the area last Friday. The tornado had winds up to 205 miles an hour, and that was part of a storm system that swept through five states, killing at least 10 people. Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius warns that the recovery effort could be hampered because much of the state's National Guard equipment is in Iraq. For more on all of this, we're joined by Deb Groover of the Wichita Eagle. Deb, you've been to Greensburg. Residents were allowed to come back starting at 8 a.m. This morning. So what are they seeing as they arrive?
It sort of reminds me of Sesame Street's Which One of These Doesn't Belong? You know, you'll find a mattress in a tree. You'll find debris just everywhere, bricks on the street, parts of houses far, far away from where they were.
Well, as we said, 1.7 miles wide, 22 miles long. What did people who survived the tornado say it sounded like?
I talked to the superintendent who was in the basement, and he said that, you know, you could just know there was a noticeable change in pressure. Their ears popped. He looked up, and there was just sky, and a lot of people have described it as sounding like a train.
People did have a warning?
Right, they did. They had about a 20-minute warning, which officials there are saying, you know, saved people's lives. They were able to get into basements. And even people who didn't have basements were able to survive somehow.
Yeah, where are they staying now?
I think that a lot of people are staying with relatives and surrounding communities. The hotels are booked in Pratt and Kingman, nearby communities. I think a lot of people have been finding home in the shelters. But I think a lot of people are with relatives in other parts of the state.
Well, a spokesperson for the Adjutant General's office is backing up the governor's statement that much of the equipment is in Iraq. She says that while the state never has 100% of the equipment it should, there's only about 40% there now. So we understand that things like tents, trucks, semi-trailers to move debris are in short supply. From what you've seen and what people are telling you, how crucial is this going to be to the recovery?
I think it will be pretty crucial right now. You know, there's a lot of debris in the streets still, not the main road, not Highway 54, but in the streets. And, you know, they're going to need that heavy equipment to try to get those roads passable and to get people back into their homes. Also, you know, tents would come in, you know, handy for people who are there assisting the recovery effort.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency has brought in travel trailers. Is there an indication of when people might be able to move into those?
No, they haven't actually brought them in yet. They're on their way, I believe. But the problem is that there's so much debris left in the community that there's no place to put them.
Well, we know this tornado was part of a storm system that went through five states, and now there's a threat of flooding in those areas, I'm imagining, because everything's been leveled. You know, how is the weather becoming an additional concern?
Well, I, for one, am sick of rain. and our state already is flooding. I mean, we have pictures in our paper today of semi-trucks, pretty much submerged in water and parking lots. So it's a big concern, and I think that for people who are trying to get back to their homes, you know, they're frustrated because the last couple of days it's been raining. So anything that they could have gotten out on Friday, you know, probably is even more damaged.
In addition, there have been additional tornadoes, and we understand you saw one up close.
I did, and for someone who prides herself on not being scared of any new situation, I have to say that I was very frightened and pulled my car over and ran to a ditch. A colleague of mine, a photographer, was shortly behind me. We decided to try to get back into our cars and outrun the tornado. It did touch down. We have great photographs of it, but it was frightening.
And this was Saturday?
Yes, this was Saturday between Haviland and Greensburg.
And what was that like? Again, it wasn't the F5.
Right. It was scary. You know, it was scary. I mean, I'm from Kansas, and I have been known to mow my yard while sirens are going off, but this was the first time that it was so close. And I suppose having just seen the destruction made me even more frightened. You know, I just had witnessed what had happened, and so the idea that a tornado might be headed for me was pretty bad.
Deb Groover's with the Wichita Eagle speaking to us about the tornado on Friday that leveled the town of Greensburg, Kansas. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Deb mentioned how she's sick of the rain. Well, that storm system that spawned the F5 tornado in Greensburg did bring severe thunderstorms, and now residents across the Central Plains are being forced to flee their homes due to flooding. Emergency workers used rafts to rescue about 500 people from their homes in Topeka. High waters also blocked roads and led to evacuations in parts of Iowa and Nebraska. So far, nearly 7 inches of rain has fallen in Topeka. More than 6 inches of rain fell in 24 hours in southeast Nebraska, and the National Weather Service says more rain is expected. Well, staying in the nation's farm belt, an activist journalist says maybe that belt needs tightening. Michael Pollan and other food researchers are asking the question, why is it that more poor people in the U.S. are overweight than rich people, when not so very long ago it was the other way around? It's the question at the center of a movement that takes us from an examination of obesity and diabetes to the supermarket aisles to, of all things, the Farm Bill, which is currently up for reauthorization in Congress. Michael Pollan navigates that trip for us in a recent article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. He's the Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of the book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. He's been talking to us quite a bit about food issues recently, and we welcome him back to the program. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be back.
Let's go to the supermarket aisles first, because you point out something we've heard before, but you really, you know, draw a bead on it. How, for instance, the supermarket is set up and how food cost comparisons go. Give us an illustration.
Well, you know, the mystery, as you suggest in your lead-in, is why is it that people with less money should be the people suffering from the highest levels of obesity and diabetes, when historically people with less money are skinny and don't eat that much and don't eat that well? And there was a nutritionist at the University of Washington who set out to solve this mystery, and he performed a very interesting, very simple experiment. He took a dollar into the supermarket and went about trying to find out where, if you only had a dollar to spend and you were in the market for calories, which is what we're in the market for, especially if we don't have a lot of money,
right,
where could he get the most value for his dollar? And you know how the supermarket is set up? You've got the fresh food around the periphery, the milk and meat and fish and produce. It usually lines the walls. And then in the middle is the great processed canyons of snack foods and sodas and all this kind of stuff. And what he found was that a dollar bought you a lot more calories in the middle of the store.
Right.
In fact, you could get something like 1,200 calories if you were shopping for cookies or chips in the middle of the store. But if you wanted fresh produce and you went over to the carrots, you could only get 250 calories for a dollar.
Right.
So we have a situation where the least healthy calories, because those ones in the middle are the ones with all the added fat and all the added sugar, are the cheapest, and
right,
the most healthy calories are the most expensive.
So if you are someone on a real low income, you are going to be stocking up on potato chips and processed foods and the things from the middle of the store to get the most bang for your buck. You make a comparison, and it's interesting because you mentioned Twinkies in your comparison, and not too long ago we spoke with Steve Ettlinger, who wrote a book mm-hmm. called Twinkie Deconstructed. He told us that a Twinkie contains 39 ingredients, goes through an amazing high-tech manufacturing process, then there's packaging and marketing, and you'd think that all of that work would make the Twinkie super expensive. But you
yeah,
make
it should cost $5 or $6 for a Twinkie when you think about all the effort and technology that goes into it. There are those 39 ingredients, and each of those, many of those, that's not simple wheat and sugar. I mean, if you read those ingredients, there are a lot of very complex molecules synthetically derived. But because of the way our food system is set up, the raw materials of that Twinkie, which are really corn and wheat and some soybeans, and of course the sweetener all comes from corn, high fructose corn syrup, you would think that that would become an expensive item of food. But in fact, those are precisely the kinds of crops we subsidize most heavily. And then you look at the carrots, and miraculously, this very simple bunch of roots ends up costing more than this complicated Twinkie. And that's because we do very little to support the grower of fresh produce.
So a Twinkie costs less than a bunch of carrots. And that brings us to the Farm Bill, as you said, how our government subsidizes farmers. Here's where my head starts to explode just a mm-hmm. little bit, because, you know, it's counterintuitive. So explain further, how is it that the government subsidizing of, let's say, corn, how does that lead to a cheaper product?
Well, in the simplest terms, we pay corn farmers by the bushel for what they can grow, so that the farmer has a strong incentive to produce as much as possible, because that will drive up his payment from the government. And the government payment to corn farmers represents up to 40% of their income these days. Now, there are ways to help farmers and support agriculture that does not lead to this overproduction. But the way we're doing it now, by essentially cutting them a check for every bushel they can grow, is bound to lead to an immense overproduction of corn and soybeans in particular. And these are the building blocks of fast food. We are, in effect, subsidizing the growing of high fructose corn syrup at a time when we have an epidemic of obesity and diabetes. It's absolutely absurd.
Are you saying that the reason that so much corn syrup goes into sodas, for instance, is because there's so much corn syrup around?
Because corn syrup is very cheap.
Yeah.
And the result is that over the last 30 or so years, since we have been subsidizing corn in this way, the amount of high fructose corn syrup each of us is consuming is up around 42 pounds a person per year. Mm. It's an astonishing amount of corn syrup.
And it's going into places that you don't even know you're drinking it or eating it.
It's now ending up in bread and pickles and salad dressing. I mean, if you go around the store looking for HFCS, or high fructose corn syrup, you will be amazed where it turns up. And the reason is that we are, as creatures, hardwired to like sweetness. So if you, as the food scientist, can work a little more cheap sweetness into your product, you're going to sell more of it.
Yeah. Well, now let me stop you there and say, but wait a second. Subsidizing farmers is about keeping land farmed as opposed to, overrun with developments. And this is just a necessary side effect of trying to keep our farmers in business.
I disagree with that. And in fact, I'm not against spending money to support farmers and keeping farmland in agriculture. I think it's vitally important. But it's really the way we do it, the way we've designed the rules of the game. In the past, before this switch to direct payments to farmers to grow as much as they can, we used to lend them money when the price of their crops dipped below a certain target. And that allowed them to take the loan money and not sell their product, hold it back in the silos. And that would take corn or wheat off the market and keep the price up. And then when the prices went up, they could sell their corn and pay back the loan. It was a system that worked quite well. But then we switched to a system of just cutting them a check whenever the price dipped below the target. Mm-hmm. Now, this didn't make a difference to the farmers in a way. It made a huge difference to the buyers of their commodities, the Coca-Colas, the Cargills, the Tysons, all the companies who want very cheap crop prices. So that's the real beneficiary of modern subsidies. People depict it as welfare for farmers, but that's absolutely unfair. They're really essentially laundering money for ADM and Cargill and Tyson and Coca-Cola.
Because, again, they can then take that crop, let's say corn, turn it into corn syrup, pour it back into products which that they can then sell more cheaply because the government has literally underwritten them. Michael Pollan is talking about the connections between the food we eat, the price we pay for it, and how that's determined by the National Farm Bill that's currently up for a rewrite in Congress. He's the Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Also, we know him as the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. Well, when we come back, we'll look at how Michael says this is what's in the Farm Bill affecting not just American farmers, but farmers in Mexico and Nigeria, how it distorts the world economy, impacts immigration, and what we could do about it. Also, later in the show, the man who will probably succeed Tony Blair. Gordon Brown has no serious challengers yet, so where does he stand on Scotland's call for separation on the war in Iraq? That's later today. But we'll be back after a quick break with Michael Pollan, here and now. It's here and now, and we're back with more from Michael Pollan, Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. We've been talking about the food available in our supermarkets, how much it costs, its nutritional value, and how Michael says that's determined not by the market, but by a piece of legislation called the Farm Bill, which is now up for reauthorization in Congress. The current bill expires in September. Michael, you've told us how Farm Bill subsidies encourage the overproduction of a handful of crops, such as corn and soybeans and wheat, and how they are then processed and dumped into American products in the form of, say, very fattening corn syrup. But make your case that what gets supported in the Farm Bill has repercussions far beyond our supermarkets and our pastures.
The reason the Farm Bill is such an important piece of legislation is that it not only affects our food system and what we put into our stomachs, but in fact, it affects the world's food system. When Americans can sell corn or other commodities so cheaply overseas, we essentially sell them for less than they cost to produce. So when you dump that kind of corn on, say, Mexico, as we did after NAFTA was passed in 1994, you are putting all those Mexican farmers who can't produce it that cheaply because they're not being subsidized out of business. And essentially, since NAFTA, 1.5 million Mexican farmers have been tossed off the land because they couldn't compete with cheap, subsidized American corn. Same is true for farmers in Nigeria trying to make a living growing cotton. They can't compete with the American cotton coming in, which is being sold at less than it costs to produce. So it has a very distorting effect on the world economy, and it is, as people like at Oxfam will tell you, it is one of the very most important impediments to raising the income levels of farmers all over the world. And it's not as though it's helping farmers. I mean, farmers have been going out of business regularly. This system leads to ever lower prices because the more that's produced, the price goes down further. And that is not a boon to anybody except the buyers of this stuff and people who, you know, like junk food, because it is what makes junk food cheap.
Well, and we should say that it not only does it have an impact on farmers in Mexico, but you draw the line to a higher rate of illegal immigration as they come across the border here, as we send corn there.
Exactly right. If you're throwing farmers off the land in Mexico, what are they going to do? They're going to either go to Mexico City and find themselves impoverished, or they're going to emigrate to the United States. So you really can't understand the pressures driving the flow of people north unless you understand the pressures of the corn moving south. That flood of cheap corn is partly responsible for the tide of immigration.
It seems like a pretty tightly woven system at this point. I mean, you've said that you don't think this is as much about supporting farmers as supporting the junk food business, but people don't want to see farmers go out of business. I mean, what has to happen in your mind to change it?
Well, I think we have to figure out a new way to support farmers. I think we need to pay them for being good stewards of their land, for example. There are programs like the Conservation Security Program that Senator Harkin introduced last farm bill that essentially pays them for taking good care of the land, not for producing as much as possible. So you can change the incentives so that you get a food system that is based on quality, both of farming and of the crops coming off the land, rather than sheer quantity.
Because as you write, this isn't just about the Twinkie. This reaches all different communities. The public health community has to recognize it can't address obesity without addressing the farm bill. The environmental community has to recognize that if a farm bill promotes chemical and feedlot agriculture, we can't have clean water. And the development community has to realize that global poverty can't be fought without confronting the farm bill.
And all those constituencies just now waking up to the fact that the farm bill, which everybody used to think was this parochial issue involving just Midwesterners, but the farm bill is really a food bill, and it affects all those issues. And until we look at the farm bill and try to align our agricultural policies with our public health, our environmental, and our development goals, we will have no success in all three of those areas, because farming, as we're practicing it now, is the biggest source of pollution in this country, the biggest source of cheap calories making us fat, and the biggest impediment to third world farmers getting ahead.
It strikes me, Michael, in reading your article, that the community most affected by this is the one with the least voice. The people who are activists in these realms are pretty much buying their organic food at farm stands and have, you know, a small revolution going on in their own lives. But poorer people
cannot take part in that revolution right now.
Right.
I think that that's true. And I think we're moving to a bifurcated food economy where healthy food will only be affordable to people with money in the middle class and upper middle class. And that's just a crime. I mean, that the poor can only afford these fat and sugar calories. But there are things that can be done in the farm bill to level the playing field between these unhealthy calories in the middle of the store and these healthier calories on the periphery. And that's really what we have to focus on, is mechanisms to either drive down the cost of fresh produce or raise the cost of artificially cheap junk food. Because, you know, it may seem cheap, but in the long run, of course, those cheap calories are incredibly expensive to your health, to the public health, to the environment. And if we calculate the real costs of cheap food, we realize it's not such a bargain.
This is the year that the Farm Bill comes up for re-examination, rewrite. It happens every 5 years. This is it. Do you think anything's going to happen? Have you had a response?
Yeah, I've had a surprising, very positive response from people on the Hill and activists in various groups. There are a lot of politics around the Farm Bill now that we have not seen in decades. The way the Farm Bill has always worked is that it's been a very closed-door negotiation between the farm state legislators without anyone else paying attention. Indeed, those of us who live on the coasts, live in the blue states, very often our legislators are simply trading away their votes on the Farm Bill because they don't think their constituents care. If every congressman heard from their constituents that they really want to see a Farm Bill that is in line with our goals for nutrition, that is in line with our goals for the land, in line with our empathy for farmers struggling around the world, we will get a better Farm Bill because this Farm Bill really depends on people not paying attention. And this is the year that people are paying attention.
Michael Pollan, Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Okay, a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, bioethicist Arthur Kaplan says the massacre at Virginia Tech highlights what he calls pathetic inadequacies in the mental health care system, and he poses the controversial question, do the mentally ill now have too many rights? Also, Asian actors in Hollywood, parts that don't call for kung fu or karate are hard to come by. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Beowulf as action hero. That's after the news, Here and Now.
Support for Here and
It's Here and Now. French President-elect Nicolas Sarkozy says he's taking some time off to unwind after winning Sunday's runoff over socialist Ségolène Royal. Sarkozy hopes to chart a new course for his economically sluggish nation to make it more friendly for businesses and less inviting for would-be immigrants. He reached out to the U.S. in yesterday's victory speech, a sign of his desire to break the tension that took hold under outgoing President Jacques Chirac, particularly over the war in Iraq. Well, as new leadership takes over in France, Great Britain, where there's been strong support for the war in Iraq in the Prime Minister's office, is also getting ready for a transition. This week, Prime Minister Tony Blair is expected to announce the date for his resignation, clearing the way for Finance Minister Gordon Brown to become Prime Minister, Brown facing no real opposition. So who is Gordon Brown, and how will he affect U.S.-British relations? To find out, we're joined by John Prideaux. He's Britain correspondent for The Economist magazine. He's speaking to us from London. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Robin.
So who is Gordon Brown? What role does he currently play?
Well, he's been finance minister, or chancellor, as we call them here, for Tony Blair ever since Tony Blair's government was elected in 1997. He and Tony Blair go way back in politics. They both entered parliament in 1983. And really through the whole of the 80s and the early 90s, they were a bit of a duo. They were often seen together at Westminster.
Well, in fact, remind us, they did both come to power in 97, but many people thought it was Gordon Brown who was going to be the prime minister. Remind us of that history.
Yes, that's right. I think for the whole time from about 1983 to about 1994, Gordon Brown considered Tony Blair to be the junior partner in their relationship. Gordon Brown was more sort of political animal. He had been in politics for longer than Tony Blair, and he's also more sort of academic than Tony Blair is. And so I think he impressed people early on with his command of a lot of subjects, which is something that Tony Blair had to learn later on.
But as you point out, the Tony Blair run for prime minister was sort of unstoppable, this wave of excitement about him. So the two men made a backroom deal to share power, Brown getting control over England's economic strategy and in exchange for supporting Blair. What's been his record, Brown's record?
His record's been good if you just look narrowly at how the British economy has been doing. It avoided going into recession shortly after the dot-com crash, when some other countries' economies weren't doing so well. Really, the countries had uninterrupted growth. I mean, it's arguable how much of that's really, really down to him. But you know, certainly he hasn't messed that up. So he has a pretty good record on that score. Some people think that he has increased burden of regulation on businesses and has had a tendency to sort of fiddle a little too much with the tax codes and generally to sort of complicate things rather than make them simpler.
Meanwhile, Tony Blair leaves office dogged by the war in Iraq and his support for President Bush. Remember, critics called Tony Blair Bush's poodle. Will they taint Gordon Brown with that same brush?
Well, Gordon Brown was also a supporter of the war in Iraq, but not in a very vocal way. And it's been a feature of the relationship between these two men over the past 10 years that quite often when Tony Blair has been in a bit of trouble, Gordon Brown hasn't really spoken out and sort of helped him out in public. But he was in favor of the war. I think Gordon Brown is Atlanticist, like Tony Blair. I suspect that he will not strike up quite such a close relationship with the current American president, Mr. Bush. But we'll have to see about that.
Well, and some people might find that appealing, again, given the way the war in Iraq is going. But a recent profile in your magazine, the headline reads, "One of Britain's most impressive politicians is poised to become its next prime minister. Why is the country less than gleeful at the thought?" What's the answer?
I think there are a couple of things. One is that he's been in power for a long time already. I mean, finance minister is the second most powerful job in the land, and he's been a particularly powerful finance minister. And so he's been around right at the top of politics for 10 years, and I suspect that after 10 years of the same government, people are thinking that it might be nice to have a bit of a change. Not that the current government has been particularly awful, but just I think that's the way politics works. It tends to be a bit cyclical. And I think, Gordon Brown, it's going to be very hard for him to present himself as a change. So I think that's a big thing. I think a second thing is that he doesn't have the sort of natural political sort of charm and charisma that Tony Blair has. And so I think comparisons with Blair, as far as those things go, will be unfavorable when he gets into office.
Now, how will he fare with some of the topics that might be on the table for him? For instance, this growing movement in Scotland to break away from Great Britain, which picked up steam over the past weekend when people who want to separate won more seats in Parliament.
Yeah, that was pretty bad news for him. I mean, he's Scottish, as you point out. He also represents a Scottish constituency. And Scotland last week voted just narrowly for the Scottish Nationalist Party over the Labour Party. And the Labour Party has really been very keen to stop any talk that Scotland might be able to go alone. So that's going to be a big problem for him, actually, to deal with in Scotland. And it's also, his Scottishness is a bit of a problem in England as well. One of the things that's happened over the past couple of years is we've seen support in opinion polls going up for the idea of England having some sort of representative parliament of its own, much in the way as Scotland and Wales now do. So the sort of Scottishness is a big thing for him.
And remind us, what does England have now?
Well, England has the parliament, which sits in Westminster, but that's the parliament for the whole of Britain. England, unlike Scotland or Wales, or now Northern Ireland, doesn't have its own assembly that just deals with English things.
Well,
there are some people saying that England should have that.
Well, you mentioned Northern Ireland. It seems ironic that Great Britain is facing this movement for independence in Scotland as Protestants and Catholics seem to be coming together to govern Northern Ireland.
Yes, that's right. I mean, that's one of the great things that's happened in the past 10 years during Tony Blair's premiership, is this coming together of the two big political factions in Northern Ireland. We have to see which way that's going to go. I mean, the nationalists there, the Sinn Féin, are still very keen to break away from Britain and unite with the rest of Ireland, whereas the Democratic Unionist Party, the biggest Protestant party there, are still obviously very attached to the union with Britain. So we'll see which way that plays out. But the good thing is that they're sitting down and talking with each other.
John Prideaux, Britain correspondent for The Economist, speaking to us from London about Gordon Brown, who most likely will be the next British prime minister. And John, as we said, many Brits seem to have turned on Prime Minister Blair because of his ongoing support for President Bush. But how are they, and as you write in the magazine, they're not, jumping for joy at the idea of Gordon Brown coming in. He hasn't lit any passion in the people. But so how are they viewing this change?
Well, I think with a bit of weary resignation, there's no major challenge to Gordon Brown. So he's sort of inheriting this position as leader of the Labour Party and therefore Prime Minister. It's a rather odd situation. It's not one that occurs too often. And people feel they're getting this new leader, but they're not actually getting a chance to say, yeah, this is the guy who we'd like to have as Prime Minister. And so I think people are slightly annoyed by that. And there's a bit of a feeling of, oh, well, there's not much we can do about this. We're getting this guy, whether we like it or not.
John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, still to come today, old, old English in the digital age. A new DVD features a man, his harp, and the story of Beowulf. You're listening to Here and Now. Did you know that there's a bull riding circuit here on the East Coast? One of the stops along the way, Massachusetts. And as Here Now's Lara Farrar reports, cowboys from Brazil are dominating what's known as the World Cup Bull Riders Competition.
It's a chilly afternoon at the Brockton, Massachusetts fairgrounds, and a slight breeze ruffles the suede fringe of Wanderson de Oliveira's green chaps as he mounts a 1,600-pound brown and white bull. De Oliveira straddles his legs across the midsection and tightly wraps his hand through a rope that's slung around the animal's shoulders. The cowboy nods his head, the metal gate flies open, and man and beast are off and bucking. De Oliveira has been riding bulls for 14 years. He started as a teenager in Brazil, where, after soccer, rodeo is the most popular sport. He soon made a name for himself on the Brazilian scene. Now he's seeking fame and fortune up north.
I think it's the most important thing in a cowboy career is come to the United States and give a shot over here. If he does well, he can be a big star and a rich man too.
De Oliveira isn't famous yet, nor rich. A full-time construction job supports his bull riding passion.
Mickey!
Today he competes against 34 other cowboys from Brazil, the U.S., and other nations for the first event of the World Cup Bull Riders 2007 season. Kenny Churchill is the cowboy in charge. The champion rider founded the World Cup Bull Riders Association 7 years ago. He got the idea after talking with Brazilian cowboys who were attending bull riding clinics on his family farm in Maine.
I said, well, if we did a rodeo back here, would the Brazilians come to it? And they said, Kenny, you have no idea if you had Brazilian bull riders there and, you know, did some Brazilian music, what that would do for the Brazilian culture. I says, well, we talking like, you know, a couple hundred. And they laughed and they said, no, thousands.
My friends waited for 1 month this party. Everybody's so excited about this moment.
We feel here like we're in Brazil, you know. Everyone hang around and everyone enjoy themselves like in Brazil, believe me.
I like being here today because it's exactly like my country, you know. Everybody make barbecue, everybody funny, people Brazilian, my friend, and a lot of America too.
More than 5,000 rodeo fans have turned out for the weekend-long event. There are Guatemalans, Mexicans, Cape Verdeans, and a few gringos like me. But Brazilians rule the day. As Brazil's national anthem rings out, dozens of vendors hawk cowboy boots, t-shirts sporting the Brazilian colors green and yellow, and of course, soccer balls. Out in the parking lot, there's plenty of barbecue to be had. At the makeshift Carnival, a tailgating soiree that lasts all weekend. It's a familiar scene at rodeos Kenny Churchill runs up and down the East Coast. Churchill says he isn't making a lot of money from the circuit right now because so far sponsors aren't interested in focusing on Brazilian audiences. But he says that could change once they discover that his rodeos are rich with the culture that surrounds Brazilian bull riding.
We try to follow where the Brazilians are migrating because it helps our captive audiences at the same time.
Back at the arena, the party has ended early for Wanderson de Oliveira. For 2 days now, he's failed to ride a bull for at least 8 seconds. That's the minimum amount of time required to have a shot at first prize, a belt buckle, and a share of the $25,000 winner's pot.
It's a big disappointment because as long as you are a cowboy, you expect to ride every bull you get on. And it's very hard to go back at home and say, I fell. But it's not the end. You keep going.
De Oliveira will return home to nurse his injuries. but he plans to be back on the bull for the next rodeo later this month. The World Cup bull riders are also rounding up herds of new cowboys from Brazil and other nations, including Japan and even China. They hope to grow the sport and broadcast their rodeos on televisions around the world, just like Brazil's other beautiful game, soccer.
Lara Farrar in Brockton, Massachusetts. To see a Brazilian rodeo slideshow, go to our website, here-now.org. Still to come, Beowulf on DVD, Here and Now. It's Here and Now, and it's a scene right out of the Middle Ages. A bard picks up his harp and sings the tale of the great hero Beowulf, who comes to the court of King Hrothgar to slay the evil monster Grendel. Here, Beowulf introduces himself to the king.
Was du Hrothgar?
Now there's a hello. It is Old English, but it's being performed today, and the audience is hanging on every word. You're kidding, you say. Beowulf, that book everyone has to wade through in high school? Yes, it has the monster Grendel and mead halls, good-looking Danes, or so I thought, wielding swords. But still, Beowulf as showstopper? Yes, because the bard is musician Benjamin Bagby, who's performed his version of this ancient epic to audiences around the world for over a decade. There must be something in the air, because a full-fledged film starring John Malkovich, Angelina Jolie, and Anthony Hopkins is in the works. But Benjamin Bagby got there first, and his one-man show is now available on DVD. Benjamin Bagby joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Good to be here.
I have to say, when I listened to this, first of all, I thought it was Swedish.
No, it's English. It's actually the original form of English as it would have been spoken in the 8th or 9th centuries.
There are places where you can hear that. I wrote a few down. God and thanken, we thank God.
Mm-hmm.
But remind us, Beowulf, why is it so revered?
It's one of those quintessential stories which come from a tribal culture, a culture which is living perhaps in a lonely part of the world. They live by their myths, by their stories of their leaders, the battles that the ancestors have fought. And by retelling the Beowulf story or hearing it again and again, they are reminded of the courage and the wonderful history of their own people.
Plus, there's great battles, and then you get to go drink mead in mead halls. Okay, it was written somewhere between 700 and 1100 A.D. King Hrothgar, whose hall is besieged by the monster Grendel, literally Grendel shuts down the bar.
Absolutely.
And then what happens?
For 12 years, they are destitute, without any means of defeating this monster. And the story travels, of course, as seafarers come and go, and the story goes to other lands, and it's in what is now southern Sweden that a young warrior named Beowulf hears this story, and he decides to enhance his own glory as a fighter. He will sail over there with his friends and defeat this monster.
You know, I'm wondering, do you think, and I know especially on the DVD you speak with Beowulf scholars, do people think that there was a monster of some kind? I mean, what was Grendel, do you think?
We'll never know. He's described as being a descendant of Cain. He's not described ever in great detail, but we know he has claws like steel spikes, and we know he can eat 30 warriors at one mealtime. So he obviously has a very large stomach. A bit cannibalistic, also. Grendel is definitely humanoid.
Huh. Can you perform a little bit of the work for us and set the scene of what we're about to hear?
Yes, this scene is when Beowulf has landed on the Danish seacoast. He's talked his way past the coast guards. He's managed to march with his men to the hall of Hrothgar, which they use during the daytime. They just can't go there at night. And he has first encountered a little resistance from some of the local toughs. And then Beowulf introduces himself. And he explains that he's come on this mission to help, but he needs to see the king Hrothgar.
We sind hier lakes Belgianertas, Beowulf is min nama. Will ich ha setchan suno helftenes merfeuden min arende. Elrathinum, if he us ja unnan wille, that way in us war good and great and moton.
Benjamin Bagby performing his Beowulf. What drew you to this?
I think the beginning comes from when I was 12 years old and my English teacher gave me a copy of Beowulf and said, I think you'll enjoy this. And I was crazy about it in the way that all 12-year-old boys are crazy about those kinds of stories. And it only dawned on me years later when I was involved with the performance of medieval music that this story had actually not functioned in the Middle Ages as literature. It wasn't a book designed to be read. It was something passed on in oral tradition and something which was given voice by professional bards and singers. And that really piqued my curiosity.
What's it like to do this performance? There's one point in which the subtitles indicate Grendel the monster and the hero Beowulf are fighting, Grendel's losing, and to illustrate, you're just, you know, arguing and wailing. It's a very emotive piece. What's it like to perform it?
Every time I perform it, it's different. And it really has to do with the audience which is present, the type of hall I'm in, whether my instrument, the lyre I use to accompany myself, is functioning well or tuned well. And it's much more about storytelling than about singing or performing or giving some kind of musical performance. It's very much about the give and take between an audience and a bard.
There's also, in addition to the physicality, the epic battles, the drinking, there's great philosophy. At one point, you say, men do not know where demons direct their footsteps. By the way, can you remember that in the old
English? Oh, sure, yeah.
What is that?
Men ne kunnen hvor de helrunen rift om skrivet.
And at that moment, I said back to you on the screen, how true. Those thoughts do resonate.
Absolutely. And they really come to us from our deepest tribal past, not our identity as a nation or our identity as any kind of Europeans or Americans or whatever. It's really that idea of living in a small band of people who depend on a strong man and his henchmen and his toughs to keep us safe from the other strong men who are living perhaps in the next valley. Mm. And that kind of elemental fear that we will be overrun by our neighbors.
Or that if we go preemptively to attack our neighbors, men do not know where demons direct their footsteps.
Yeah, so who's the demon?
And where is that demon pulling you? Right. We've been speaking with actor and musician Benjamin Bagby. He's been performing his version of the ancient epic Beowulf for years, and it's now on DVD. And by the way, are you surprised that audiences, and you can see on the DVD, they are just rapt. Friends of mine who have seen you perform say you could hear a pin drop. Are you surprised at that?
Well, I give the story the credit because it's such a fantastically well-crafted story. The rhythm and the rhetoric, it's just beautifully done. And anything I can do to underscore that, fine. But I think it's really resting in the text itself and in the language, the old English or Anglo-Saxon language, which has its own musical structure.
Right. Benjamin, what would you like to play for us as we leave?
This is a section near the beginning of the story where the bard is telling a bit of the genealogy of the tribe. And he's describing the funeral of one of the great men who had come to the shores of Denmark, washed up as a baby set adrift on the sea, and had then grown up to become a great leader. And when he died, they put him back in a boat and set him adrift on the sea again for a sea burial. And this is a part of a long lament which describes the ship laden with treasure, the body of the leader laid out in front of the mast, and then set adrift on the sea.
Him the siluato is sharp wheel, fell roar fair on un frown ware. He hinneth at barn, to brims farth, swears ye see thus. Swa his self bathen and ward well. Winnie Schillinga, Leof Land, Frumme Lange, Achte.
Benjamin Bagby performing his version of the classic Beowulf. It's now out on DVD. Beowulf, making a comeback. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.